And that's what I was planning on doing.
Excuse me, don't want to bother anybody out there. This is the Subcommittee on Human Services. We're a little short-handed this morning, but others will be joining us soon, I hope. This is April 7th, and we're having a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, and we're looking to wrap up on the key performance measures, and that will be followed by Director Lynn Saxton giving us a wrap-up of the entire OHA budget, at which point she can go home, put up her feet, and call it good. And it may not quite work out that way, Lynn, but I wish it would. LFO?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, even though we're going to do the wrap-up today, actually we're doing the next 2 days, the shared services and central services, but the shared services between both DHS and OHA.
So thank you for that. Lori, I think you're back up again, if I've got this correct. Typhoid Mary will be sitting to your left, two seats away. Please introduce yourself for the record, and let's pick up where we were last time, which I believe was on looking at immunization rates, the abysmal immunization rates in this state. And you can lead us through this. Thank you.
Yes. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lori Coyner. I'm Director of Health Analytics for the Oregon Health Authority. And we did indeed leave off with immunization rates for children by their second birthday. And as a refresher, about two-thirds of children on Medicaid have all of their immunizations by their second birthday. It's slightly higher than the percentage for the general population.
Can I stop and ask you a question there real quick? Because I thought about this last night a little bit. That's at age two. Does Oregon kind of lag other states because the overall rate starts going up? I mean, about 3-4 years of age, or is, I mean, you pick two as a cutoff because that's when most of it's supposed to be complete, and I understand that. Does Oregon lag and then sort of catch up a little bit by this third or fourth year, or do we just continue?
Senator Bates, I don't have the data at hand, so we'd have to investigate, though I don't believe that we jump up after age two and have a high rate by the time children reach school age. We do measure immunization levels for adolescents, and actually that measure is if they're up to date by age 12, and we also are low.
I know we're still below. I think the rate is around 72% for kids when they come into school. That's one because the people are madly catching up on their immunizations because the kids can't get into school without it. But there's so many exemptions, of course, that it's almost impossible to track. If you could give us some more information about that later, it'd be kind of nice to see.
Yes, we'd be happy to.
And against other states, it's abysmal either way you look at it. But thank you.
Senator Bates, to our next point, it does vary quite a bit also regionally within our state. So this is a graphic of the CCOs. The darkest dot, those brown dots, are the most recent data. The gray dots are 2011. And so there is a variability with Cascade Health Alliance having 77% of children immunized by age two, and then some of the lower down just above 50. So there is quite a lot of variability across the state.
Can I ask you where Cascade Health Alliance is, just for the record, please?
Yes, it's in Klamath County, Klamath area. This measure is two parts, and so it is the proportion of OHP members who have initiated alcohol or drug treatment when it's been identified, and then whether they continue that treatment. And you'll see we have made some gains on treatment initiation, but not for continuation. So the continuation, I believe, is having visits after the initiation is a visit within a week or two of being diagnosed as having a problem, but the continuation would be subsequent visits following that.
I would like to make just a comment. I want to keep interrupting. We're trying to get past key performance measures to talk about what we do, and we want to be talking about what the effect is, what the outcomes are. So maybe we should be talking about this a little different way. You know, what's our level of alcoholism, and so on and so forth, instead of just we put them through a program and nobody knows what happened at the other end. So as a statistician, I like to have you think about it that way, if you would, a little bit. No change today, just general comment, okay?
Senator Bates, it's funny, I did have a conversation with staff yesterday about this. We're working with someone from the jails and looking at alcohol and drug use and recidivism, and we can report that back. We've just started the work.
Thank you.
This graphic shows the variation in initiation of alcohol and other drug treatment. It's improved for racial categories or racial ethnic groups except for Hispanics, which are the bottom dots. The reason that we don't have dots for Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders is we suppress the data if there are too few people in the categories. This next measure, which is from CAPS, or the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems. It's a self-reported survey, and the percentage of members on OHP who feel healthy increased from 2011 to 2013. So this is actually asking members if they feel that they are in good health. The children is answered by the parents. And we see this consistently where children's health is self-reported as much better than adults. We've been watching this next measure. It's one of the core metrics that we report to Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and we have been seeing reductions in preventable hospitalizations. This particular measure here shows hospitalizations for diabetes, and it would be short-term complications. It's a rate, so it's per 100,000 member years, which is a little complicated, but so it's not a percentage, but we have seen decreases over time for a host of these measures. This one, a little bit less of a change in between 2011 and 2013. We'll be watching these closely as we get more data from the expansion population.
Is there any way of calculating from that the savings to the system if you're putting more money into primary preventative care versus hospitalization rates going down? Is there any way to calculate that delta and compare the two? It may be an impossible thing to do. CCOs may be able to help you with it.
Senator Bates, yes, we can take a look at the cost changes either through our hospital discharge data or the all-payroll claims.
Should be big gains there, but it's just intuitive. I can't really prove it, obviously.
We can also report that back.
Yeah.
Here's another example of one of the preventable hospital admission rates, and this is due to or showing hospitalizations for congestive heart failure. And again, we've seen a consistent decrease, which is exciting. We also see a similar pattern for COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. The last set of metrics that I'm going to present, we are population health metrics. They are not metrics that we report to Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, nor do we track them closely with the CCOs at this time. Oh, I take that back. The rate of obesity and the rate of tobacco use are two of what we call our core measures. So those we do report to Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. However, there are no financial penalties tied to them, and we reported them publicly for the first time in January.
Okay.
So this next metric shows illicit drug use, and it's decreased slightly between 2012 and 2014. This is for middle school, high schoolers, and it is data that's self-reported from the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey and the Oregon Student Wellness Survey.
Any questions here? I got some. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In previous Ways and Means subcommittee hearings, in previous sessions, we've asked questions about how believable it is when we have studies of self-reported statistics. We were skeptical that smoking statistics were accurate. You know, it may show a trend, it may not. Can you please talk to us for a minute about how useful it is to be reporting things where someone doesn't necessarily have an incentive to report accurately?
Chairman Nathanson, I will have to ask both the administrators of the survey what they do to promote better answers from students. These are anonymous surveys, so the students know that they don't put their name on it. It's completely anonymous. There is probably a response bias. There are students that probably are not honest. But on the other hand, without any data, you don't have a way to assess trend or to look at increases in use of things such as, a good example would be electronic tobacco cigarettes, e-cigarettes. So in recent data, we see increases when we've asked. And so there is a way to use the data for monitoring and surveillance. The Oregon Student Wellness Survey we provide to counties for planning and tracking drug and alcohol use among teenagers.
Brief follow-up. I'd be interested to hear what the nature of the survey is and how I'd like to be able to understand why people will believe that it's truly an anonymous survey, that if they report, no one's really going to find out where it came from. I'm skeptical enough that I don't answer anything that comes to me and they say, oh, it's going to be anonymous, because I figure, oh, they can find out what computer it came from, or maybe the survey has a little embedded number in it somewhere that I don't see, but they're going to figure out where the response came from. And I would think that with as much as it's popularly known that we're being tracked all the time. What do you buy over the internet? You know, what sites do you look at? What movies are you interested in seeing next week? I would think that whether it's paper surveys or electronic surveys, some people are going to be thinking about, is this really anonymous? So I would like to see what is the nature of the survey that lets people believe and have confidence that it's truly anonymous.
Chair Nathanson will be happy to provide that information. These surveys are conducted within a school environment, but we can get the details on how they're administered.
Thank you very much.
Chair.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. I'm curious if you guys have had much pushback on some of these surveys from the public. I've had some constituents, you know, seek me out, and I don't know if it was this specific survey, but just concerned with when their children are being asked about drug use, and that some of the surveys, both for drug and sex, where we're introducing topics that the children didn't know existed. And so some parents have contacted me saying, hey, we're really upset about this. What do we do about this? Have you guys received that sort of pushback, and what is your response to those concerns?
Co-chairs and Representative Stark, I will have to ask staff, but we do provide contact information if people have concerns, and we will provide you that information.
And are the surveys optional? You may have already covered that, but for the students in the school environment, can they opt out of the survey?
Co-chairs and Representative Stark, I will have to get the details from staff. There are two surveys. They happen on alternate years. One is the Oregon Healthy Teens, and the other is the Oregon Student Wellness Survey. And I can't remember which one's on even years and one's on odd. The samples are a little bit different, and the survey administration, and we will provide the information on both surveys for you.
Thank you.
Obviously, this is pretty sensitive information you're getting, but it's also meaningful.
Meaningful, yeah.
So I'd like to ask a question about this particular slide. What illicit drugs are we talking about here? I'm especially concerned about, I mean, of all three groups, but sixth graders, 12-year-olds, and eighth graders who are, what, 14 or 15?
So these would be any drugs that are not legal.
Legal for that age, or legal?
Legal.
Are we talking about nicotine, alcohol, or illegal for that age? Or are we talking about you know opiates and tranquilizers and all that kind of stuff? You know, could you differentiate that at all?
Yes, Chairman Bates, we ask about tobacco use, alcohol use, and other drug use, and this particular measure excludes alcohol and tobacco in this measure. And as a matter of fact, the next slide shows alcohol use.
But this slide is strictly for medications that parents has been handing me a note on, or grandparents, or something get off the street. So we're really talking about some serious drugs here. Not that the other nicotine and alcohol isn't bad enough. We're talking about strictly stuff that they shouldn't be getting into at all.
Senator Basia, yes.
That's sad but meaningful. Thank you.
This slide shows the alcohol use among teens within the prior 30 days. I do want to mention that this particular graph shows teens throughout Oregon and is not limited to those on the Oregon Health Plan. We've seen a decrease in alcohol use for among all ages since 2012. This next slide shows the proportion of adults aged 50 to 64 that received a flu shot, and it's stable, and we have not seen improvement over time, though Medicaid adults tend to have, at least in 2011, were more likely to have a flu shot than the general population. This next slide shows the proportion of OHP adults who were obese, and it was 52% higher than the general population.
Question, Senator Winters.
And we know that's a problem. What are some of the strategies, and I know not all strategies work for individuals, but it's a serious, serious issue because it's an issue that also has other diseases attached, particularly diabetes, cardiovascular, and some of those. You know, here in Marion County, you know, I started 5210, I Love Me, just to start to begin getting individuals to deal with this issue of, we don't use obesity anymore because we found that it had a stigma to it. And so it turned people off rather than turning them on in order to get them to exercise and to begin to do a better job with their nutritional intake. So what are there any plans afoot to try to address this issue?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, I'm not aware of any particular. However, I would need to check with public health and see what they have in terms of programs. I do not believe the Transformation Center has any specific learning collaboratives around obesity.
I believe some of the CCLs are doing wellness programs and trying to get people to exercise. I know at least one of them actually includes in their Advantage plan gym membership. It's part of it's paid for by the premium. So I don't know what they're doing in Medicaid, though. So, but I know Medicare are doing that, and they're trying to push this. But Senator Winters is absolutely correct. This is an epidemic, as we all know, and needs to be treated as such. So we'll be here. This is the messenger. And we'll remind everybody, this is, you know, the institute reporting the crime. So we'll be looking at OHA from that point of view and seeing what they're doing. Okay.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we can check in with public health and report on programs that are directed towards reducing adult obesity.
I think there's two things. One, the programs and determine whether or not they're working so that we can actually see the level of obesity going, reducing and going down. It's one thing to have programs because I think there's a lot of information out there. You know, when we started here in Marion County, it's not for lack of information. It's there. It's how do we actually get individuals to actually do it? You know, how do you begin to get the nutritional change that occurred? And so anyway, program's one thing, and getting tracking is another one of doing it. So, and I know you're the messenger, but I really think that we've got to make a concerted effort to address this issue. The collateral part of it, like I said, and it's the cardiovascular, the diabetes, which actually consumes the largest part of our budgets. You know, when you begin to look at the cost, the other part of it in addressing this issue, and I know we kind of sometimes take it lightly, but the statistics say that we're going to lose the next generation anywhere from 10 to 20 years of life. So, I mean, I keep talking about this because I do think it's serious enough that we need to really begin to do some targeted initiatives just on this particular issue alone because of its ramifications on the other end. And I know you're the messenger, but I would just implore everyone who has something to do with wellness to begin to concentrate and focus on this particular issue.
And even though it's a big hill to climb politically, we need to start looking at the SNAP program seriously about what you buy on SNAP. I know it's a how do you touch the third rail here with the grocers, but it's time to start looking at that and really make some tough decisions. Senator Steiner Haywood.
Thank you. My apologies for being late. I was testifying about tobacco, so I figured that's relevant. This question may have been answered before I came in the room. I was flipping through all the slides to catch up and noticed that a lot of the benchmarks are pretty low. And did you talk a little bit about why they're set so low? Is that just to sort of not make everybody feel completely inadequate and to get it to keep raising them over time? What's the plan there? If you already talked about it, then we can take it offline.
Co-chairs and Senator Steiner Hayward, the benchmarks that we're showing in these slides are the benchmarks that the coordinated care organizations are held accountable for. They were selected by the Metrics and Scoring Committee. They're reassessed every year by the Metrics and Scoring Committee, but they were generally selected to be the 90th percentile for Medicaid nationally. And the original idea was that if the coordinated care organizations hit those benchmarks, then our OHP program would be in the top 10% nationally in terms of performance. It doesn't mean that we have to keep those benchmarks static, and the committee does review them in cases where they think it needs to be higher. An example was the electronic health record adoption measure. They dramatically increased the benchmark because the CCOs kind of hit the first hurdle, as it were.
Okay. Thank you.
The other point, too, is that we want achievable goals, and our CCOs are actually rewarded financially for hitting those goals. You set really super high goals and never achieve them, it sort of turns people off trying to make it. So you've set good standards, they're achievable, they get pay for the doing that, and then we can keep moving them up slowly and steadily and do better and better.
Chairman Bates, yes, that was the idea.
Representative Boone, I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, I did, and you did hit the first one, was the reviewing what SNAP can pay for. And I didn't want to get into that right now, but looking at these statistics, and they're a little bit different years, but for the kids, they're doing better, and that the adults in the Medicaid community are doing worse, but they're still like a year behind, so maybe 2014 stats will improve. And Senator Winters just pointed out that these are some of our highest costs are because of this, and if you look at the next slide, it's tobacco use, and if you combine tobacco use and obesity and poor nutrition, you're going to get all these things. And so what I was thinking of is something we heard the other day. I think we were talking about smoking, and somebody said, well, you know, when people stopped smoking, they started gaining weight again, and they made that choice to continue smoking instead of that. And so I don't know if that's being looked at in there, too, because of that issue and what Senator Winter said about we have the programs, we have models, we have everything, and we have incentives to exercise more and stuff, but how to engage people. And it looks like what maybe we should take a page out of the kids' book. How are their numbers going down? It's obviously education or something, because kids usually feel they're bulletproof and they don't care about that. They say, I can do anything, you know, and it won't hurt me. But it looks like their incidence of the alcohol and drug use is going down. And I don't know, you don't have a slide here on their obesity rate, so I was wondering about that, if you keep those two in those age groups so that you can kind of compare them alongside the parents. But I do want to say about the SNAP thing is I think that is, I hear complaints from my constituents about that who are in the grocery stores, and they say, I see people paying with SNAP and I look what's in their basket and that's not what I want my tax dollars paying for, and that's not helping the overall picture, you know, in that sense. So
great.
A lot to food for thought. Great.
Next. Please continue.
As Representative Boone, let's see. Oh, mentioned this last slide, I believe, is the second to the last slide is the tobacco use among Medicaid members compared to the general population, and this shows a dramatic difference in tobacco use between the two populations. We have the information also by CCO, and there is quite a lot of variability around the state also in terms of tobacco use. I do want to mention, just because we brought up kind of interventions and all, the public Health Division recently released a report on the tobacco cessation benefits that are available to Medicaid members and by CCO, and there was a recent learning collaborative at the medical director's meeting to talk about effective methods to reduce tobacco use, and so there has been some concerted work between the Transformation Center and the Chief Medical Office and Public Health to begin to address this issue.
A particular concern to me here is the fact these two lines are separating, and actually there's actually an increase in smoking in the Medicaid population. Mm-hmm. Is that because this was before the ACA population came in? This is 13, right?
Yep.
And do you have any numbers from last year?
Chairman Bates, this is before the expansion population was included. We did just field what's called the Medicaid Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, and we'll have numbers from that just probably within the next... I think the draft numbers are out, so we should have a report out within the next month.
It's particularly concerning to me when you figure the cost of cigarettes, the cost of their health, these people living in poverty, and we have all kinds of programs to support them, and they're spending $100-$150 a month on cigarettes, which are wrong in so many different ways to be doing. We've got to somehow drive this to the other direction. I'll put it back in the pocket of the CCOs. They're the ones who should be doing this. This is not a good slide to be looking at. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on several days of testimony that we've just had from public health and the proposed $4 million drop in tobacco master settlement dollars for county and state public health. And we're shifting that, or the proposal is to shift it to the CCOs. So I would be interested in the slide that shows which CCOs have better rates than others. I know some have some really innovative programs with their partnerships with their county public health. And I think if we do make that shift, it's going to be really important that we somehow come up with parameters to tie those dollars to ongoing programs and not kind of recreate the wheel. There have been some excellent programs. And I'm not advocating necessarily to drop the $4 million, but if we go in that direction, I think it's critical that we build really strong partnerships with the tobacco prevention TPEP programs that have shown some really good results before we throw that out.
I would add to that that I don't want just programs. I want outcomes.
Outcomes.
I want to see those numbers driven down. I don't care what programs they use to do it, but they're not getting it done, then we'll pull the money back out if we even put it in the first place. And Representative, I think you'd probably agree that you want outcomes. You
absolutely
want these numbers going down.
Which is why I want to see those slides, because some I know are doing some excellent programs and have some really great results.
Representative Kenny Guyer and co-chairs, we do have that graph available, and I'm sorry it's not in the slide deck, so we can provide that. And there is quite a lot of variability between the CCOs in on tobacco prevalence. There's been lots of discussion at Metrics and Scoring around adopting a tobacco prevalence measure as an incentive measure for 2016. And at the last meeting, they asked to have three CCOs come and present on some of the innovative programs they're doing. So we can report back if that measure does become an incentive measure. And it would be tobacco prevalence and not, counseling or that sort of thing, but an actual outcome.
Can I ask a clarification?
Follow up.
So I had heard that was the recommendation to make it a incentive metrics in 2016. Was that just a recommendation or was that already approved?
Representative Kenny Guyer and co-chairs, it was a recommendation. It has not been approved. It was on the slate for 2015, and then there were questions about what the CCOs could do to move the needle on prevalence, and that was partly why they asked CCOs to come and present on innovative programs so that the committee could feel confident that there were steps that CCOs could take that could change tobacco use.
I think this topic is this and obesity are the two big topics that drive healthcare in the state.
Yep.
And a short presentation by OHA on how the different CCOs are doing in these two areas, I think would be worthwhile for this committee to see. Representative Nathanson, do you agree with that? So we'll schedule that in through LFO sometime in the next couple of weeks. I mean, if we really want to drive costs down and really want to do the hard stuff, it's getting people off cigarettes and getting them to lose weight. That is not easy. I've been singularly unsuccessful in taking care of obesity in my practice, but I've been very successful with cigarette cessation, other than the Medicaid population, which are the most resistant. So I'd like to hear more about that.
And Mr. You know, we actually handed off 52102 Salem Health, which I'm very pleased that they agreed to take on that responsibility and activity. So there are out there some things that are going on in some communities, and I think that when you talk about outcomes and adding what really is taking place, public health here is involved with this particular program, by the way, but I think there's a lot we need to not only know, but what strategies to drive this issues, both cigarettes and obesity. And like I said, using the term obesity with individuals does have a negative connotation, we found. And so the individuals were resistant to getting involved. And once we changed to wellness, because I think we ended up with 45,000 individuals who have taken now in Marion County the challenge, the 30-day challenge, to begin to change the habits. So I think we need to talk about language as well, and I don't know what they're doing across the state, but language, had a real negative connotation when we talk obesity.
Thank you. I really appreciate bringing that back to us later. Okay. Representative Kenny Guyer, would you like to take the lead in this a little bit and
sure.
help us out?
Love to.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-chairs, we'd be happy to bring that information back.
Please continue us.
So next steps on the key performance metrics, we will continue to use data to inform policies and practices about healthcare disparities, access to integrated behavioral, oral, and physical health services, and key population data to drive public health strategies, as we've just discussed. These data also can be used to monitor and learn about the new Affordable Care Act population to understand their needs and utilization of services, and to, in the case of CCOs, provide incentives to drive our desired outcomes. For more information, we've provided a link here for our 2014 mid-year performance report. This is focused on coordinated care organizations and the Oregon State Health Profile, which is focused on population health, and my contact information is there in case you have any follow-up questions. Thank you.
Questions? Lori, thanks for your help today and yesterday also. I keep reminding everybody you are the messenger, and you keep bringing stuff we don't like to see sometimes, but we need to see it. And I've always said that what gets measured gets done. If you don't measure it, you're just out there floundering around. And we have been very, very mm-hmm. lax at times in this building of measuring outcomes. I mean, what is really working and not working? And I appreciate that you're trying to bring us good data so we can see what's happening out there. I appreciate it. And I want you now to go over to K-12 to measure their outcomes and higher ed to measure their outcomes. I think it's important we get these things done. And you can do that on weekends.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Wow. So, Lynn, are you going to come up and give us the wrap-up now? And before we get started, can you remind us of some of the members didn't have a chance to get it earlier? We're going to do a wrap-up here today, and there's no committee meeting on Monday. Is that correct?
That appears to be the case.
All right, and the next 2 days are going to be shared services?
Right.
Is that correct? Okay.
And next Tuesday, we're still trying to work out whether we have someone coming back or not. We're working out dates here yet.
Okay. Okay, good. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, thank you for the opportunity today to wrap up our presentation on this phase of the Oregon Health Authority. Before we walk through a few quick slides reflecting a summary for your reference of the work, I wanted to say a couple key points, particularly with regard to the role Oregon Health Authority has in meeting the needs of your constituents. First, before I do that, I just want to say thank you for your questions. I think your questions have been robust, detailed, and have made us pause and look at things that we need to address in different ways, and I'm very appreciative for your engagement and those questions. This is Oregon's healthcare transformation is a collaborative project. It takes all of us leaning in to make it work and to be successful going forward, and I appreciate your commitment. First, I just want to say thank you to the Oregon Health Authority workforce, which has done a tremendous job under very turbulent startup conditions to achieve the triple aim, and we're well on our way to doing that. We have accelerated enrollment. We have adopted a metric system. Although it's in its first generation, it lays the groundwork and the cornerstone for results-driven, outcome-driven healthcare transformation in Oregon, and I'm very excited about the opportunity to continue to build on our successes using that metric system as the cornerstone. Third, CMS remains a fan of what Oregon is trying to accomplish in Oregon, and that's very important. We've had a lot of turbulence. We've had a lot of challenges. CMS still looks to Oregon for innovation and is very supportive of what we are accomplishing here. Next, I just want to highlight that this is an agency that, having gone through 2 years of leadership transition, committed 3 weeks ago to a complete agency restructure in the midst of all the other challenges we're working on. That restructure is underway. Every single division of the Oregon Health Authority will be going through a lean process, and that work has already begun. So I want to commend the agency on being willing to take on that heavy lift so quickly and with such enthusiasm. And finally, I want to commend the workforce on taking on the task of redeveloping our 2015 rates. That's been a very difficult work project for us, but we've taken it on. We're committed to it, and we'll have our work done by July 1st. So not something we want to do in the future, not anything we look at lightly, but very important commitment on our part to building quality infrastructure financially for the ongoing success of the Oregon health system transformation. I want to touch on the results that we've attained for Oregonians. They're important. They're why we're here. First of all, 95% of Oregonians now have health insurance. That's significant. We have more gains to make, but that's a very impressive first start. Secondly, we've successfully bent the cost curve, freeing up state money to be used for other purposes. We are ahead of some states, we are slightly behind some other states, but we are in the race to change the cost of health care in the United States today, and you all deserve a lot of credit for that, and Oregon should be very proud of that work.
Lynn?
Yeah.
What states are we behind in bending the cost curve?
We're behind Tennessee, and I'm waiting for the other two. I don't have the names, but
I did a quick search. I did a quick search on Tennessee last night. I may be wrong about this, but at this point, I don't believe that they have accepted the Affordable Care Act expansion of Medicaid. So we're comparing apples to something else.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's not even oranges.
Understood.
It's not even a fruit. And if you want, I can beat Tennessee easy in the state. I just disenroll everybody that's in ACA, drop us down to about 85% enrolled, cut rates to doctors and hospitals, and I could beat Tennessee.
Yeah. We're mindful that we need to compare apples to apples, and we'll bring that back to you because I agree. They have
Not that we're in the final four or anything here, but, you know.
I want to give recognition today to the Oregon State Hospital. We just completed our joint commission review. We shared that press release with you, but we are waiting for their final report. It was noteworthy in their review of Oregon State Hospital that they think we may be one of the best in the country in meeting patients' needs. I want to underscore that this doesn't mean we have everything right, but it does mean that in terms of our highest priority, which is meeting those clients' needs, we are seeing some real success and change there. Finally, I want to acknowledge PEB for their remarkable achievements. I think if you look at PEB and how they've addressed, one of the numbers we dove into when we were looking at those results is obesity and tobacco. And PEB has some very impressive responses and successes with regard to those indicators, particularly obesity, and it's a model that we will draw on for future success. Clearly, we face some significant challenges going forward. We have to achieve financial sustainability. I will have a six-year projection of the Oregon Health System Transformation financial model for you probably about the second week in May. We've started that work. We're looking at it. We have to get – there's a lot of moving parts to projections, and we want to have the best possible information to bring forward. So we will begin scheduling appointments with you all in May to share that six-year projection. I think it's going to show some real challenges, but I also think it's going to show some real opportunities for us as we move forward. And we're excited about having that model to use as our North Star as we go forward to be sure that this system is operating with financial sustainability. Secondly,
I really want to highlight this for the committee. It's amazing to me the room is half, you know, it's not 1,000 people sitting here. This is going to be the budget driver, I believe, for the next 5 or 6 years. At the end of this biennium, the last quarter, we start picking up a little bit of that expansion population for general fund support. And that delta, as it goes out the next 5 or 6 years until we get to the 90-10 match, is going to be really, really, really important. If we don't hold costs down through our CCOs, this whole thing is going to be a house of cards coming down. And we have to do that. So the information you're going to give us is really important. Working with our CCO partners to keep costs down is really important. And it affects our entire budget and the entire economy of the state. So This is really big dollars and really important. I don't want us to lose sight of that. It's probably the most important thing we'll look at in this session for this budget. Representative Olson.
I probably should have this conversation with you out of here, but I just heard what you said, and I appreciate that. I really do. What happens when CCOs are in the black? I mean, very healthy-wise.
When they're really, really in the black, we have to look at two things. Mm-hmm. Okay, one is what are the reserves that are required over a period of 2 or 3 years at a time? Because we've got some CCOs, a lot of money, but we don't know what reserves they really should have. They're required to have, I believe, about 5% of what their take is. I mean, what their total budget is, they're supposed to have, I think, about 5%. Commercial insurers, I believe, are supposed to have about 10%. That's a lot of money in reserve. Mm-hmm. So whether you call it profits or reserves is important. Number two, I think after this year, we'll have enough sort of semi-solid data on this expansion population to really be pretty accurate about setting rates. Right now, we're really, really having a difficult time. We don't have enough data. If we find that we're in a situation where they have massive reserves above what they need, then we have to do some serious talk about, okay, how do we bring rates down? Are people being paid properly from their systems? And how do we keep that delta down by being more careful with what we give them? So those are the kind of questions I believe we'll be looking at in about 3 or 4 weeks. And I don't think we should take it offline. I think we should do it openly and mm-hmm. transparently, because it's a huge and important question, and I appreciate you bringing it up.
Yeah, okay, thank you. That helps.
Okay. Yes?
If we're talking still about things that we hope we're going to talk about a little bit more, I brought this up a little bit yesterday, but I remain concerned, or more accurately, eager to think about the collaboration between the CCOs and DHS services and DHCS in terms of housing. We know, for example, that a lot of people who are on Medicaid don't live in adequate housing. And when you're exposed to mold or things like that, that certainly increases your health risks. So I think it might be helpful to the committee and to our colleagues at the Health Authority, to everybody, to talk a little bit more about how these collaborations are happening and how the CCOs are working with housing organizations and other providers of safety net services in their communities. I'd like to know a lot more about that, because that was always the intention with the CCOs.
Well, I had two things to ask agency head here about. One was long-term sustainability. She's already brought that up to us. The other one I had written down was housing. So what do you have to say?
Sorry.
No,
didn't
you're spot
mean to jump
on.
The gun.
No, you're spot on. I made a note to myself. What are our big issues? You laid them out for us, so please continue.
Thank you, Senator Bates. We are committed to that cross-section of services that delivers the result, which, of course, includes social services and housing services. And we'll continue to look at ways to bring that forward in the context of the CCO's work. I do want to identify a second challenge for us, which is the mental health service system in Oregon. Having spent 13 years working in that system, I am passionate about ensuring that we are getting the best possible outcomes, particularly when benchmarked nationally, not just within our own state, but holding ourselves accountable to a national standard. We will have a map of the mental health services in Oregon available probably the end of May. It will be a first draft. It will show dollars invested, location of services, outcome-driven services, or gaps in outcome-driven services, and those indices will be available for each population, including the adolescent population, distinct from the children population. So that work has begun at Addictions and Mental Health. It's challenging work, but I think it will give us a platform for your policy and decision-making in mental health. It will include in our partners in refining that information base, will include schools and the criminal justice system, because those are our partners in ensuring we have a mental health system that works for all citizens in Oregon. Our third...
Can I stop you there for a minute?
Yep.
Again, you've hit one of my topics, okay, and I'm sure it's everybody else's too. You mentioned this would be available to us the end of May. Is there any chance we can get it a little earlier? It helps us set our budget. By the end of May, we're locking budgets down. We're looking at getting out the end of June. The mental health issue here is so huge. I'm particularly concerned about what we call the back door. And we've got programs springing up all over the state that I believe take care of the front door with, you know, things like in Marion County where the police bring people to not the jail but to a mental health facility. And I would like to think of, when we think of mental health, think of drug and alcohol at the same time as equal programs. And don't take them to the ER at the hospital. Take them to these new facilities. What I'm worried about is the back door. And this goes into wraparound services and housing again. And I don't think we have, as anecdotally, I don't think we have enough housing out there right now. When I talk to people setting these programs up and the handoff out of the program into the community, I'm still concerned about. And I don't believe we're doing what we need to do, and it's going to be driven by this budget of how much we put into housing and wraparound services when they come out of these facilities. I want us all focused on that.
You've got more nodding heads up here because I think we're all really have the same concern and the interest in, and it's refreshing to hear you talk about in collaboration with public safety and DHS, because that's now become critical. I think we, you know, recognize that the no longer can we operate in a silo, and so
right. Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, committee members, we will look at getting that done earlier. I think it's never been done before, and so I think we can get it to you earlier. I just want to underscore, it's not going to be perfect out of the chute, and it's going to be a starting point, but it is going to drive data-driven planning, which is really critical to having successful outcomes. So, yes, we will focus on getting that earlier. Our third challenge is, as we've discussed previously, is the march to Kentucky. Again, I want to give recognition to the Oregon Health Authority.
Not Tennessee.
Yeah, it's not Tennessee. It is Kentucky. I want to give credit to the Oregon Health Authority team, who is sitting at computers every day, enrolling people, redesignating people, using very, very clunky stuff. And I appreciate their hard work, and we're going to make it to Kentucky in an improved system. And finally, we remain committed as an agency this year to really doing intense work on the populations that are already reflected as disproportionate populations in the outcomes, and identifying resources, services that will meet their needs quickly, so that we don't build in disproportionality in the Oregon health system transformation for Native American, African American, Hispanic, and other populations in our state. That's something we've taken on, and it's hard work, and we're going to be driving those metrics hard to make that go down a different path. So with that, I'm going to go through these slides quickly. You've seen them before.
Can I, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I'm so sorry. And I don't know if this is a question for you or Ms. Coyner, but I'm going to ask you since you're sitting here. It occurs to me to wonder, given your point about health disparities in our minority populations, whether the Metrics and Scoring Committee has considered at all having a metric related to health disparities, because I didn't really see any. I don't remember there being any. I may just not have looked at the list carefully enough recently. But it strikes me that that's the kind of thing that, I mean, it's not relevant to all CCOs, obviously, or some of them don't have big enough minority populations. But I'd be really interested in wondering about that question.
So I'm going to let Lori amplify my response, but let me see if the response will start. Is what we have right now is the ability to look at every CCO and find out how they're doing by diverse populations. And so particularly what we've found already is that we have some, for example, with Hispanic pregnant women in Southern Oregon, we have some real success stories, and part of what we're looking at is how can we export those methodologies to other CCOs. I'll let Lori respond too.
They did a switch while you were talking to me. Thank you.
Co-chairs and Senator
transformation.
Steiner. Yes. Steiner, it's interesting you bring this question up. There is no metric currently that metrics and scoring has selected that's directly related to healthcare disparities. However, at their last meeting, one of the committee members asked that the committee look at possibilities. Nationally, there really isn't a standardized metric to look at disparities, but it is work that metrics and scoring just asked the fellow committee members and staff to review.
Follow. So it's interesting that you say that nationally there isn't a standard. There may not be specifically, and so that may be part of the challenge, but certainly one can parse out, you know, if you've got a Caucasian population and an African-American population, whether they're getting their blood pressure checked often enough, or whether their lipids have been checked, or whether their diabetes is under as good control, or whatever. Those don't require national standards. Those require intra-CCO or intra-Medicaid, Oregon's Medicaid population comparisons. And then the next step is getting everybody up to that 90th percentile. So I get that there aren't any national standards, but if there's a national standard for everybody that we're using for hemoglobin A1C and diabetes, then the question is to look within the Medicaid population in Oregon and within each CCO and say, well, where are you now in comparison with those patients, and where should you be?
Co-chairs and Senator Steiner Hayward, you're correct, and that's the work that the committee has asked staff to investigate, is whether we can come up with some sort of incentive that promotes closing the gap on healthcare disparities. We don't have it established, and that was work that was asked for the next three months or so.
Great. Thank you very much.
I have a question, because we use the term disparities, but I want to know what's disparate. Because in healthcare, there's a lot of facets. And so when you say disparities, and I'm going to go back to the good senator, if we're tracking, what specifically are we tracking?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we do report each of the metrics by race and ethnic group, and that is something that we report also to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. When I was speaking of disparity, I was reflecting Senator Steiner Hayward's example, where there's a difference in the health care services or health of populations that, where we want them all to be equal, so that you know, you don't see, as the example that Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, where one particular racial or ethnic group has a difference in their how often they're tested for their hemoglobin A1C or levels of hemoglobin A1C. When if the healthcare was adequate across all groups, that you wouldn't see those differences.
We're getting there. There's a battle.
Several battles. There's the battle of whether or not that the person has access, if they do have access, whether or not that access is being used. There's the other battle of where, from the service standpoint, whether the same follow-up is given to that group than the other group. You know, if I talk to the various cultural groups, what you probably get back is that, one, it's difficult to get access. Two, I don't get the follow-up services, my counterparts, and some of those, not to where I got my hemoglobin test or whatever. And then the other part of it is that I don't think they understand when I tell them what my symptoms are. So some of it is communication, some of it, and the other, you know, I like the one on diabetes, because in some cultures that's called sugar. you know, and so the conversation, the communication is different. But anyway, I'm just trying to wrap my arms around how do you actually begin to track, you know, and the other piece of it is CCOs and services usually are physically someplace that's not central with where the particular groups actually reside. That's another question, and so those kinds of things. But I'm not going to go off on my tangent.
Okay. At this moment, she will later. Lynn, we've got about 20 minutes left. You've got 20 slides we've already seen. Nothing personal.
Yeah.
And I really like to throw it open to the committee to ask questions. They have an opportunity to ask questions that might be on their minds, but also to give you an opportunity to jump to those slides to think that you have some special information you'd like to give us that you may not have had a chance to present to us before. And if you don't, we can always leave early, just saying, okay? So, committee, is there any particular questions anybody would like to ask that they're particularly concerned about? We have the agency director here, and we don't always have her here, so if you have questions you'd like to ask, now's time to do it. Seeing nothing, jump to those slides.
Okay. I'm going to go really quickly here and skip some slides, so Kate will help me with that. I do want to just, you know, I look at this every day. So this is what success looks like in building sustainable health care for the Medicaid population. It has to look like this. If it doesn't look like this, then we continue to dance on the margins of thinking we're helping these people. So put that one on
your wall. These general fund dollars?
Pardon me?
Total dollars saved,
general fund dollars.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Kate Nass with Department of Administrative Services. This is in total funds, and this is health plan, PEB, and OEB. So we're looking at health care transformation across all three systems in total fund dollars that's included in the governor's budget.
Love to see that broken out for general funds.
Love to.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
You know about the triple aim?
Keep going.
Many of you have asked questions about the CCOs. This is our CCO map. If any of you would like one of these for your own, we have them in different scales and size, but it's important to know, particularly to Senator Steiner Hayward's question, when we talk about working horizontally with other state agencies, we need to be mindful that everyone's boundaries are different, and so part of the way we do that is look at those boundaries and have people working across boundaries. Budget, but this is federal dollars. Let's go back just to federal dollars. There we go. Just again, keeping in mind, over half of these funds are federal funds. We have a very critical partner in the room on every discussion about healthcare transformation. They will be more in the room in the future going forward as the entire country incorporates the implications of the Affordable Care Act. So we need to never forget that these are our business partners. Keep going. 98% goes to direct provision of health services. That's an impressive number. I call that to your attention. I do want to underscore that 9%, this is where the general fund money goes, is 9% goes to direct services provided in state public health, but also the Oregon State Hospital is funded by state dollars. That is a workforce of 2,000 employees. I just want to keep that on the radar screen. These are our significant budget years, pointing to the bottom half, showing those reductions in ACA subsidies. In this six-year projection that we'll be showing you after May 11th, it will show the reduction of those subsidies over time and the implications for Oregon's financing of the system.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How does that play out on the reduction of the subsidies? And is that to people, individuals, or is that for the whole state?
For the whole state. And part of what the challenge is to do, the three things we have to do at the same time is the subsidies go away, the cost savings have to continue, right? That's the urgency of the cost savings. And then also we need to be continuing to transform health as opposed to just doing what we've always done. So we have to get those three things happening at the same time to be successful.
Okay.
So over five follow-up, just 5 years of, we've got 5 years of subsidies, and then they end. Is that trying to? I can't.
They decline over the next 4 years.
Okay.
And maybe it's fair to think it was not as subsidies.
Yeah.
We have roughly a 2-to-1 match on what I'll call the old population. For every dollar we put up, the feds put up two. On the expanded population, in the first year and a half, or almost 2 years, we don't. We just get it. We don't have to put a penny into it. Mm-hmm. And then it starts going down. And we, you know, we have to start picking up 1 or 2%, then 3%, 6. Ultimately, out there in 5 years, we pick up 10%, which doesn't sound bad, except it's 10% of a huge population, and that's the rub. And so that 10% becomes a huge amount of general fund dollars that we have to come up with in some way, shape, or form. You know, hospital assessments, whatever we do. And we can help that way. If we keep costs down so that 10%, well, it's still 10% of the cost. If the overall cost is coming down that 10%, an actual number shrinks. And that's what she's talking about. And it keeps me awake at night.
Yeah.
Okay, because that 10% can eat up the rest of the state budget.
Yeah.
And then your only option is to disenroll those people,
yeah,
or dramatically cut benefits.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of things you can do, but it gets very painful.
I do think, because we're going to be talking about mental health and we're going to be mapping this $2.7 billion in mental health plus the other funding streams for mental health, so I call your attention to this slide because it shows the two divisions of Oregon Health Authority right now that fund mental health services in the state. Their separate funding map is the Medicaid funding. AMH is population funding in addition to Medicaid funding. And the challenge we face as a state is to deploy this money in conjunction with our partners throughout the state in an outcomes-driven manner. Love this slide. You know, PEB has done an awesome job. OEB as well. More work to be done there. We can skip that. Skip that. We're good. I do want to, Bill peeled me off the ceiling last night because I know you all have a lot of questions and we've given you a bunch of answers to questions today, and we've given you some in previous submittals, but I just want to note that we have more questions to respond to, and Bill reassured me that we have a couple more days to get those into you. So people are working hard to do that. We appreciate those, and they will be forthcoming. So thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, I would just be curious if Bill's scared of heights.
We'd like to have an answer to that question, please.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayward.
The woman at the far end of the table. The right end, you'll notice. Ms. Saxton, one of your slides that you kind of breezed over a little bit, which is fine, was about behavioral health services. And it remains a significant concern of mine that most Oregonians don't have adequate access, and that's regardless of their insurance status. Now, obviously, you're not specifically responsible for access to health, mental health services for people with commercial insurance, but OHA does look at overall health status for the state, and that's certainly a significant percentage. Has your agency thought at all about the distribution and types of mental health providers that would be necessary to best meet the core needs of Oregonians? There's going to be a follow-up.
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, we have at length, and that is the reason for the mental health map that we are producing, is because the goal over time with mental health has to be to get to a broader proportion of the population with successful interventions. And so what we expect to see in that map is areas of robust services covering the need. Part of what we'll be projecting on that map is the current need for mental health services and the projected growth in that need over the next, probably we'll start with 2 to 3 years. That will show us where we don't have services and how they're funded, and that will begin what we hope will be a very thorough discussion of how we get those services in place in the right locations with the right outcomes at the right return on investment for the cost of those services, and particularly how we, and this is something I'm very excited about, how we get to a higher percentage of meeting need than we currently are. Because if you don't spend those resources correctly, over time you just meet the estimates are somewhere to 35 to 45% of the mental health need, and if you just do that year after year, you have a failed system. So our goal will be to use that map to target growth in interventions, in part by directing funds to successful interventions as opposed to status quo.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So one of the, there's two parts to this. One of the things we've been talking about a lot nationally and certainly here in Oregon is this whole concept of working up to the level of your license, which is to say use the person with the lowest level of qualifications who's qualified to do a given job, right? Don't have physicians doing what nurses can do and don't have nurses doing what medical assistants can do. And that applies, I think, in behavioral health as well. Mm-hmm. And so the two pieces of this question are, first of all, when you're doing this map, are you looking at which schools actually have adequate numbers of school counselors, and what the qualifications of those school counselors need to be? And the second is, are you including in this map licensed clinical social workers and licensed professional counselors who do have qualifications, who are licensed, and provide important cognitive therapy for people? Not necessarily medication therapy, but many people don't need that. So
co-chair Bates and Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you for identifying additional things we need to include in the map.
And again,
I'm going to say this one more time. It won't be perfect right out of the chute.
But I
do want to say that two things are occurring concurrently which will be responsive to your concern, which I share. One is that we'll be doing the map and getting that information identified. Secondly, in our redesign of the Oregon Health Authority and our change in the Addictions and Mental Health Department, which will be fairly significant, part of what we'll be looking at is what are the best practice evidence-based requirements of working up to the level of your license, and what administrative rule changes may be necessary for us to address to ensure Oregonians benefit again from exactly that, using our investments wisely and using the right people for the right interventions.
Let me know how I can help.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
I'm not going to ask you to add anything else. But I'm just listening and knowing that some of us have had some heartburn and really wanting to have some changes and really wanting to begin talking about mental health as a system. And so I just want to, in a very short period of time, you've been with us. And in this short period of time, I think those of us who have listened, I'm just really, really pleased with what I'm hearing. And I need to say that, you and the staff who are talking about to put together mapping and redesign, and recognizing that it won't be, perfect. I understand that, but it's a beginning. And the other thing that I'm appreciative of is the transparency that you're bringing before us. I sat here and we hear a lot of palaver, and today I'm extremely pleased. And I'm going to call you Lynn instead of Ms. Saxon because I've known you too long. But really, it's refreshing. And bringing forth to us the mapping plan, the redesign, and letting us know not only where you're going, but talking about what the return on investment will be and the outcomes. And I'm looking forward to it myself, personally.
Thank you.
Me too.
I am also, but I'm going to task you a little differently. Senator Steiner, he would hope you take this the wrong way.
Please.
We need a rough map at least. It doesn't have to be perfect the first time, and we need it early.
Yes.
June is too late.
Yes.
Last session, we took a chunk of money and threw it at mental health. I have no idea where that money really went, what it did or didn't do. It may have helped a lot of areas. I think I know it some places in Marion County did, others it may not have. We don't want to do that again. We want to have something to say, if we're going to make investments, as Senator Winters said, that we have some hope that it goes to the areas that really need it. And I'll give you a parallel in another budget where that didn't happen, so it'll make sense, I hope, what I'm saying. On the K-12 budget last session, we set aside money for school improvement, and we set it up on the basis of grants. And what happened was that money went to very specific districts. As an example, Southern Oregon didn't get a penny of that. Not a single district down there was successful with grants, even though they have some of the lowest graduation rates in the state. We don't want that kind of stuff happening anymore in mental health. And since we don't really know where the money is going, we don't really understand the systems, what you're doing with this mapping is incredibly important. Don't let the good get in the way of the person.
Right.
Give us what you can, as early as you can, so we can start saying where that money should flow, because this committee's responsibility is to partially direct you at where to spend the money.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I would agree, your last slide says thank you, questions. And I think we just take the questions off and say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are adjourned.
Hey, Bill. You need a parachute, let me know. Parachute, let me know. Hey, Bill. You need a